Well, some of you here have heard me speak about the asteroid belt in the class. This is Tom Clark's latest piece of artwork. An asteroid belt. Yeah, they're all named. I mean, what he did is he took these NASA shots of different asteroids and painted them on this belt. Not bad, eh? So maybe our JTL friends will have to come up afterwards and check out the authenticity of the artwork. But I've never had an asteroid belt before, so. So thank you, Tom. That was great. I also wanted to just express my personal thanks to several of you here in the class who helped us with our move. And, I remember when we moved from an apartment to a townhouse, just how easy that was. And, I created all this storage in weird places in our townhouse. I now regret that I created. And especially with the boys, even after I took 3 van loads of stuff to the Goodwill, it was still a monumental task to clear out their storage areas. So, but we're in. Everything's settled. And
wait, excuse me. You gave stuff to the Goodwill, not the rummage?
Yes. I repent. So.
Beth is here.
That's right. I needed someplace close, so. And anyway, even got rid of our mirrors. That was interesting. The Smiths helped us, and Steve's father wanted the mirrors, so we hauled them all over. 4 of us it took to haul each mirror. So that was good. For those of you that are new to the class, we've been kind of going through science in the Bible, looking at a lot of biblical evidences for the God of the Bible, then going through the Bible, not quite verse by verse, but picking up those passages where there are scientific issues, either issues of doubt on behalf of non-Christians, or issues of opportunity for Christians to demonstrate that the Bible indeed is the error-free Word of God. We've made it all the way to Genesis chapter 6. It took us a while to get from Genesis 1:1 to Genesis 6:1. That's because these first 5 chapters are just so loaded with scientific issues that bring to the forefront evangelism and apologetics. The flood account will likewise bring up a huge number of issues. And as we get into this flood account, I want to remind you that of all the passages in the Bible that get the greatest reaction from skeptics, secular skeptics, it's these next 4 chapters, even more so than the creation account. And we're going to start with an issue that's kind of a side issue and quite minor, but I have discovered through personal experience is not that minor in the Christian community, and it's really not that minor outside the Christian community because of what Christians have said about this. And this is Genesis verse 2 and verse 4. So I'm just going to read this to you now. I'll start in Genesis 1:1 or 6:1. When men began to increase in number on the earth, and daughters were born to them, the sons of God saw that the daughters of men were beautiful, and they married any of them they chose. Then the Lord said, and this is just kind of a side issue, my spirit will not contend with man forever, for he is mortal, his days will be 120 years. Verse 4, the Nephilim were on the earth in those days, and also afterward, when the sons of God went to the daughters of men and had children by them. They were the heroes of old, men of renown. And so it raises the question, who are these sons of God? Who are these daughters of men? Who are the Nephilim? And what's going on here that they were here before and they were here afterwards? What's taking place here? Now, as I mentioned, we discussed this 2 weeks ago. this really has no bearing on the Christian faith, at least no significant bearing on the Christian faith or issues that pertain to the plan of salvation. And therefore, shouldn't raise a lot of controversy, but it does. And just to put it in perspective, it seems to be raising a lot more controversy in the last year or two than it has for many generations of the Christian church. I mean, if you look at church history, this has always been an interesting passage. It's raised up a lot of debate, but rarely has the debate been acrimonious. Today it is. And I think the understanding here is that I never saw this as anything controversial, because I take the position sons of God are not doing this to daughters of men, and there are no Nephilim running around. I think what's made this exceptionally controversial is that there are well-known, much more well-known than myself, Christian leaders who are promoting the idea that this is going on today, that the sons of God are visiting daughters of men, and the Nephilim are here, and we need to watch out for these Nephilim. Now, understanding that, I can see why there's a lot of concern about this passage, unlike, say, 20, 40, or 100 years ago when the concern level was quite low. I mean, after all, what do you got here? A couple of verses. What else do we have in the Bible that pertains to this subject? Not much, as you discovered last week. I kind of had you just go through some of the Sons of God passages. You got through a few of those passages, and it's going to help shed some light on what's going on here. But I want to remind you at the outset, I do take the position that there is no basis for controversy here. I got some ideas about what this passage probably means, but it's no big deal if I'm wrong. It's no big deal if I'm right. So if you think I'm right, Hayden, it's no big deal. If you think I'm wrong, it really is no big deal. Assuming that you agree with me that the Nephilim aren't here today. Okay? So what I want to do is talk a little bit about the Nephilim in such a way that, you know, maybe we can draw the conclusion that this is not an issue for today. It can help everybody relax a little bit and say, well, let's look at the different interpretations. I did devote a whole chapter to this and the Genesis question. It's very brief. I didn't say everything that could be said. And I really only discussed three interpretations and kind of gave you the strongest arguments in favor of all three and kind of let you decide where you want to go with it. What I thought would be interesting today, just as we, you know, we'll continue with the study of the sons of God and the sons of men, but I'd like to look at the physics of the Nephilim, because I think this is an issue that's usually not brought into the debate. In fact, as I've read the works of these Christian leaders that are promoting the idea that the Nephilim are on planet Earth today, they don't get into this stuff at all. They seem to miss the physics of the Nephilim. So I'd like to get into that. Now, the Nephilim go by several different names in the Bible. And this is going to really help you in trying to unravel what's going on here. Okay, that was 2 weeks ago. Let's do a little quiz. What are the alternate names for the Nephilim that we find in the Bible? The Raphaim. That's one of them. That's probably the most common one you find in the Bible, the Raphaim. Nephilim is actually a much more rare term. Anything else? The Nephilim, the Raphaim, the Anakim. Also, the Anakites. Okay, any other terms? Yes? Giants. Okay? So these are the different terms that you see referred to these creatures. All right, let's get into the database. What does the Bible say about the Raphaim, Nephilim, Giants, Anakites, etc.? And what are some of the descriptions that we find in the Bible that will be common to these Giants, Nephilim, Raphaim? They're called the fallen ones. That's an interesting point because they're never referred to as righteous. They're always referred to as being fallen. Now, we're all fallen. You know, we're all fallen human beings. But what we're getting out here is that these Nephilim, Raphaim, are universally wicked. So in terms of their righteous behavior, they fall way below the human norm. And there's not one of them that's referred to as being good or righteous in Scripture or free of exceptionally wicked behavior. Okay, that's a good one. Anything else? They're tall. Okay? There's two instances in Scripture, only two, by the way, that refer to the height. Well, actually, there's three. two that are specific and one that's non-specific as to the height of these giants, Nephilim, Raphaim. Anybody? Goliath. I mean, that's one everybody knows, right? And his brothers. They were all exceptionally tall. And, yeah, how tall were they? King Og of Bashan. That's the second example. Very good. So with Goliath, we're told in the text how tall he was. Anybody remember exactly how tall he was according to the Bible? Yeah, 6 cubits and a span. So all you need to know is what a span is and what a cubit is and your way to the races, right? Okay, a span, we know. There's only one span as a measure. A span is 9 inches. Okay, and there's only one span. But the problem with a cubit is there's 3 cubits. Okay, 1 cubit, 17 and a half to 18 inches. That's the short cubit, the normal cubit, 18 inches. Then you get the 22-inch cubit, which is called the royal cubit. And then you got the long cubit, which is 36 inches. So you got 36, 22, 18. Well, let's be conservative and say that Goliath, by the way, the text doesn't tell us which cubit it is. But typically in the Bible, when it doesn't tell you which cubit it is, you go with a short cubit. So you go with a short cubit, that makes him 9 feet, 9 inches. Okay? Go with a little longer cubit, he'd be a little taller. But a minimum of 9 foot 9. So that makes him rather tall. What about Og, the king of Bashan? It doesn't tell us how tall he was, but it does tell us how big his bed was and what his bed was constructed of. Okay? What does it say? Anybody remember? Okay, the bed was made out of iron. Yeah, the bed was, I think, 13 and a half feet long and about 6 feet wide and was made out of iron. And, you know, beds were never made out of iron in those days. But this guy had an iron bed because evidently a wooden bed wasn't strong enough to hold up his body. So that tells us he was probably a fair size. I mean, just look at us. You know, we buy beds, and you tend to buy a bed that's a little bit longer than your height. So if he's got a 13-and-a-half-foot-long bed, this guy could have been 12 feet tall. So a bed that's 13-and-a-half feet long, yeah, 12 feet tall is what it meant. Yeah. He's a little bit, you know, you want a bed a little bit longer than you are, so that would make it a little bit longer than him. And the fact that he's 6 feet wide, I mean, again, beds were narrow in those days. Kind of like the Navy. If you guys remember the your Navy days, they'd make the bed as small as possible for your body, so. Yeah, his head would go beyond the ceiling, so he wouldn't be able to fit in here. Goliath would have a hard time for that matter. So, Goliath's head would probably just top the, well, no, he'd be a little taller than this. The ceiling looks like it's 9 feet tall. So even Goliath wouldn't fit in here. Which kind of gives you perspective on the third measure you see in the Bible, which is when the spies go into the land of Canaan. And they said, we saw the giants. And what does the text say about them? Yes. Right. I mean, here are these Jewish spies going into the land of Canaan, and they see these characters and say, we look like grasshoppers. Well, you know, the average man's height in those days was probably in the neighborhood of being 5 to 6 feet tall. And you can imagine, if you run into a guy whose head sticks through the ceiling here, you look pretty small. So I remember the first time I met James Donaldson. He's 7'2", and quite broad. And as I was shaking his hand, I was staring at his belt buckle. So I felt like a grasshopper. But I mean, add a couple more feet to that, or 3 feet or 4 feet, you're looking at the knees instead of the belt buckle. So then you really do feel like a grasshopper in their sight. So now I say this because there's a school of thought today that claims, well, these Nephilim were probably 7 feet tall. Not likely based on these three measures you see in the Bible. And by the way, as I mentioned 2 weeks ago, 7 foot tall humans were a fairly common experience in ancient society. It's like when the missionaries first came into Africa, they found tribes living side by side. Pygmies, which were 3.5 to 4 feet tall, and just a few miles away, they had giants, which were 7 to 7.5 feet tall. And this was common throughout the world. I mentioned that Switzerland was inhabited by people that were 7 feet tall. And, you know, here was Julius Caesar and his legions coming into Switzerland to conquer Switzerland. Their average height was 5 feet. And the Swiss army had 70,000 men that were 7 feet tall. And they looked at these Romans and said, this is going to be an easy battle. What they failed to take into account is that Julius Caesar was an engineer, and he didn't fight them the way they expected. He came with his thousands of engineers, and they built defense works against them, and so they managed to beat the Swiss through engineering. A little plug for all the engineers here in the audience, okay? But if it wasn't for the engineers, they would have got clobbered because the Swiss had more soldiers, and they were, you know, 2 feet taller on the average. Okay. What I'd like to do now is get into the physics of basketball as a way to reflect on the physics of the feeling. And by the way, you can buy a book called The Physics of Basketball. You won't find it in our catalog. We don't see quite enough call. But Amazon.com, you can get this. And I'm going to tell you a little bit about what's in the book, but a little bit about what's not in the book, too. I'm going to need the blackboard here, so I'm going to try to take this microphone with me. Everybody got Norm's phone number memorized? Okay. Now let's bring it out here. Everybody can see it. Thank you. Okay. You all know the game of basketball. You got a court with these basketball hoops to either end, and then you got these short guys running around, and they're trying to get a basketball into that hoop. And it's not that easy if you're only 5 or 6 feet tall. I mean, what makes it easy is if you can jump high, but it's hard to jump with your whole body with a basketball above you and get it into the hoop. Not very many people can do it. Okay. But one of the things about the physics of basketball is this. You got a rather small target. That's your target. It's this little hoop, and it's only about this big. And you've got this big basketball, you're trying to get into that small hoop. And that's why there's such a premium for height in basketball. The probability of this individual being able to score a basket will be proportional to the height from which he can see the hoop. Okay, the taller he is, say he's this tall. All right? He gets to see more of that hoop area than if he's down here. And so here he is trying to lob a ball up like that. And this is his vantage point. This guy's a vantage point here. And he's lobbing the ball like so. This individual has a bigger area to shoot at in terms of angle. I'm not talking, I mean, they both have the same area that they're going for in terms of how many square inches that they're shooting for. But in terms of the angle in which this individual is trying to sink the basket, his shooting angle, he has a much bigger shooting angle than this individual does. And so a person who's 5 feet tall has got to be far more skilled in getting that basketball into the hoop than this individual. And you say, by how much? Well, it goes up with a square of the height. And so the shooting angle that this guy has to shoot at compared to this guy will be larger by the difference in the square of their height. Okay, let's work out some math here. We got a 5 foot tall basketball player here, and we got a 7 foot tall basketball player here. They both have the same skill in sinking baskets in terms of the accuracy of their shots. If this 5 footer gets 15 baskets, with 100 shots, how many will a 7-footer score? 30. Okay? Yeah, it's quantum mechanics, right? Okay, does everybody see how you get that? If this guy sinks 15 baskets, this guy with the same skill will sink 30 baskets. Because what we're doing here is we're taking 5 feet and we're squaring it. That's 25. If you take 7 feet, you square it, that's 49. And so the tall player, 7-footer, should be able to sink 49 divided by 25 times 15 baskets. So that's about 30 baskets he's going to get. All right? So, in that case, you would expect that the tallest basketball players you can recruit will be the best. And a lot of basketball coaches do that. They see some guy in high school who's 7 feet tall. They all want to recruit him because they know this. You know, these basketball coaches are aware of this. If I can get a 7-foot tall basketball player, he's going to do a lot better for me than somebody who's only 5 feet tall. But I don't think there are any 5-foot tall basketball players, although there's one that's 5 foot three. Yeah, you know how that 5 foot three guy survives?
Good runs under their leg.
Yeah, he jumps.
He's really fun to watch.
Yeah. I mean, he can actually dunk a basket. Now, I'm taller than he is, but I cannot slam dunk a 10-foot tall, I mean, because I can't jump that high. There's that old phrase, white men can't jump. So, by the way, there's some truth to that, that blacks have a little stronger Achilles tendon than whites on the average. There are some exceptions, but on the average, blacks do tend to have a little better ability to jump with their full body weight than someone who is white. Now, it doesn't mean that the best high jumpers are blacks, because what we're talking about here is the ability to jump with a ball at maximum height. A high jumper doesn't have to do that. A high jumper just has to get his body over a bar. With basketball, what you got to do is take your entire body and launch it off the floor to get the ball at maximum height. And this is where the anatomy of blacks on the average gives them a little bit of an advantage over that of whites. But there's limits. I mean, even the best jumper in basketball can jump how high with the basketball fully extended. It's a little less than 4 feet. And very few people can pull that off. You know, they call Michael Jordan Air Jordan because he is the record of having the maximum air time. So he's the best jumper ever in basketball. And he's 6 foot six. So he usually does better than the 7-footers because he can get up a little higher. I mean, if you can jump 4 feet high, then suddenly you've got more to shoot at. But there's a problem here. You've got less time to get the shot off, all right? You're only up there for about a tenth of a second. So you've got to be able to aim and launch that ball in that tenth of a second window. Whereas you've got your feet firmly planted on the ground, you can take your time and just get the shot you want. So jumping only gives you a small advantage in the sense that you've got to be pretty good anyway if you're going to be able to get the shot you want off in tenths of a second. Or if you're Michael Jordan, you've got 0.8 seconds. So, which I think is his record. His record is 0.83 seconds of total air time. Doesn't seem that long, but I mean, looks good when you're watching basketball on TV. Okay. Now, it is interesting that in the NBA, your highest performance comes in at what height level? Anybody want to hazard a guess? Yeah, it's about 6'6". 6'6 is where you get the maximum performance. If you go below 6'6, the performance drops. If you go above 6'6, the performance drops, with a few exceptions. There are a few guys who are 6 feet tall, who do exceptionally well, but they're very skilled. Likewise, you've got some guys that are 7 feet tall who can do just as well as these guys who are 6'6". But in terms of overall basketball performance, it seems to peak right around here. And by the way, when a coach gets a guy who's 7 feet tall, what does he do with him? Yeah, puts them right in front of the basket, right? And gets the guys who are 6'6 to work the ball in to get to him, so he gets there and just slams it in. But who's winning the game? Not the guys scoring all the baskets. It's the guys who are getting the ball to that guy who happens to be in the right position to. And so that's, again, a sharp coach is doing that, saying, you know, this guy who's 7 feet tall may not be as mobile as a guy who's only 6'6", but he's got height, which is going to enable him to sink baskets. Guys, get the ball to this guy who's 7'1". We'll just have him stand around in front of the basket. He's not going to have to move very much. And he's got long arms. Just get the ball to him and have him throw it in for you, okay? Or what you're going to do is throw the ball up there and have this guy tap it in. Okay, that's another good way to do it. Sure. But what you're working with is, you know, you're again looking at the physics of basketball. Now, why is this guy who is 7 feet tall, who should have, you know, what you got here is 6 1/2 squared divided by 7 squared. The 7-footer should be able to far outperform the guy who's 6'6", and yet it's not that way at all. And incidentally, if you go to 7'6", there are a few players that are 7'6", but they don't perform anywhere near as well as the players that are 6'6". And you figure a guy who's 7'6", all he's got to do is stand in front of the basket, doesn't even have to jump, just, you know, throw it in. It should be really easy. And incidentally, the tallest man that ever lived in recorded history, we're not talking about the Nephilim in the Bible, but people that we've seen where you've got birth records and death certificates and height and weight data, was 8'11". You can look it up in the Guinness Book of Records. Mother guy was 8'11". Now, he only lived to be 40 years old. You know, he died of physical exhaustion. But he said throughout his life, and he lived about 40 years ago, he says throughout his life, everybody he met said, you should play basketball. And what he kept telling people is, I can't play basketball. I'm no good at basketball. You say, gee, a guy is 8'11". He should be super at basketball. After all, he's looking down. I mean, well, he's not quite looking down, but the basket's only 1 foot above his height. He should be able to take the ball. His hands were huge. Should be able to just take the ball and just drop it in like that. And nobody can defend against him because you can't, you know, the ball's not even going up. It's just going down. So anybody tries to stop him, there's going to be, what, goaltending? So he should have been super, and yet he didn't. Any ideas why?
The 3-second rule.
The 3-second rule.
Move faster, get out of the key.
Got to get out of the key, right? That's part of it. Yeah, I mean, he's not allowed just to stay there in front of the basket, wait for somebody to get the ball to him and dump it in.
Yeah, but Andre should be enough, so he's almost already out of the key.
Well, sure, he just stay out of the key and then drop it in like that. Pardon me? Okay, yeah, there's a strength problem. Okay, let me get into this a little bit because we're getting somewhere here. There is a penalty for being tall. And by the way, in terms of humanity and average height, we modern-day Americans come close to the top. I mean, just taking a huge pop. The Swiss is not a good example. The giant tribes in Africa are not a good example because they're small population sets. Isolated gene pool, what you got there. Here in America, we got 250 million people, and we're quite tall compared to other nations of the world. But we pay a penalty for our height. We have back problems that the Roman army never faced. They were 5 feet tall. We're coming in around 5'9 to 5'10 for the men here in America. And we have back problems that most Roman soldiers never heard of. And by the way, these little 5 foot tall Roman soldiers, they carried close to 100 pounds on their back and could march 4 1/4 miles. They could march over 50 miles a day with these very heavy packs. And they had no back problems. I can tell you this. If I had a backpack that was 100 pounds on my back and I walked 50 miles, I'd be in bad shape at the end of the day. So, and most of us men here in the audience, I think, could nod our heads and say, yeah, we'd probably be suffering. Even very physically fit men here in the audience would suffer with that kind of weight, walking that fast, that much in one day. And the problem here is that we walk on two legs. Okay, as the legs get longer, as the body gets longer, we have a higher probability of falling. Okay, because we're standing on 2 feet, and the 2 feet are relatively close together. So if you give me an extra foot of height, and I'm going to have a problem, I'm going to be more likely to fall down. By the way, when you get up to be 5, 6, 7 feet tall, the penalty for falling also becomes greater. You may have seen that movie Jurassic Park, and it showed these T-Rexes charging at about 45 miles an hour on two legs. Baloney. That can't happen. If those T-Rexes were moving at that velocity, they would have gone extinct in a hurry. And that's because if they were to trip and fall, they would probably kill themselves, or if they don't kill themselves, they would so seriously injure themselves that they might not recover. Because, you know, we're talking, you know, 13 feet of height. And if you fall from 13 feet of height, you know, gravity is acceleration. It's 32 feet per second per second. So when a little cockroach drops 1 foot, it's dropping a huge amount in terms of its height. But because gravity is acceleration, it really doesn't fall with that much force when it hits the ground. Okay, one of the things that happened, we were moving into the house. David thought it'd be a great idea to get on the roof. His brother gave him a boost. So he got up there on the roof, and then he decided to jump off. And he discovered the consequences of 32 feet per second per second. Okay, he hit the ground pretty hard. We didn't have to take him to the hospital, but he had some real good bumps and scrapes as a result. Well, again, as we get taller, we tend to hurt ourselves a lot more. You know, like when I fall, I'm going to hurt myself more than if David falls, because he's not falling that far. I'm falling a little bit further. So you add another foot, you've got a problem. Okay, now the ways to counterbalance that. One of the ways is to get a bigger base of support. Okay, instead of legs that are foot apart, you can have legs that are 2 feet apart. And so if you have, and it's interestingly, when I've met some of these really tall basketball players, I've been impressed with how broad they are. You know, they have these broad shoulders and broad hips. That gives them some stability. Okay. The other thing you can do to get some stability is make the bone mass a lot more. Kind of like the principle of putting up a skyscraper. You want to put up a skyscraper and not have it fall down? You can make the vertical beams much more substantial. And that'll give you a way to have a tall building that won't fall over. Another way to do it is you make the building a lot broader so that that will help make it stable. But either way, what you're discovering is you have to put in a lot more bone mass into the individual to support the height and prevent an early demise from falling accidents. And so when you get a basketball player who is 7 feet tall, you discover that they're relatively heavy. Okay? You know, I think West Shaquille O'Neal comes in around 300 pounds, 315. Okay, now he's got to move that 315 around on the court. And he's pretty good. I mean, he's quite an athlete. He can get that body around in the court. But he doesn't have quite the mobility of some of these guys who are 6 foot six and are lighter. They can move a little bit faster. They can do things. They can do certain kinds of jumps. You know, if you watch Shaquille, he can jump. But he doesn't have to jump as high as the other guys. All right? And they try to put him in a position where he doesn't need the mobility of what's that other basketball player the Lakers have who's got lots of mobility? I'm trying to think of his name. Kobe Bryant. Yeah. Yeah, so they use those two guys where they have their physical engineering strengths. Now you get up to 7 foot six. What do you discover? There are a couple of basketball players at that height. One I remember is very tall and spindly. Okay? So he doesn't have to move quite as much mass. But because he's so tall and spindly, he's a little bit unstable. And lacking that stability, he has to be very cautious about how he moves his body. And so even though he's got this huge advantage in height and ability to sink baskets, because he has this tall, spindly body that's not very stable, he doesn't perform as well as, say, a Michael Jordan. In fact, he doesn't perform as well as a lot of players in the NBA. Now then, if you say, well, let's not go with the tall, spindly, let's go with stability by putting in a lot more bone mass, well, I don't know of any 7'6" basketball players that have exceptional stability. There are people like that who are that tall and have the bone mass to give them exceptional stability. They don't move fast. They don't move fast enough to play basketball. I mean, even a Shaquille O'Neal, you got to get him from one end of the court to the other end of the court fairly quickly in order to have him in a position to sink a basket. You got a guy who's 7'6" and weighs 400 pounds lumbering down the court. By the time he gets there, he's not able to factor in the play. Now, if you could use him as a way to block shots, you might get somewhere. Just have him stand somewhere, throw at his arms or whatever. But that has limited capability in basketball. This guy who made it to 8'11", what he discovered was it was difficult for him to walk because of his height. So running was out of the question. He could walk, but with difficulty. And say he died at age 40. The organs in his body were no longer able to support the mobility of his huge body. He had a growth hormone. You say, well, how did he get to be that tall? It wasn't natural. He had a growth hormone problem that kept his body growing. When it hit 8'11", he died. So we have Goliath here at 9'9". To get back to the text here. He's 9'9". And he had a little more than 100 pounds on his back. If you read the story of David and Goliath, it gives you a record of what he carried in the battle. And he had to go to the back of your Bible and convert all the units into units that we're familiar with. I mean, there's shekels in there and so forth. But if you convert all the shekels to pounds, you discover that at a minimum, he was carrying 250 pounds. Into battle. So here he had this height, minimum height of 9'9", minimum weight of 250 pounds plus. Yeah, going to both of these are plus. Plus his body weight. And what the text tells us is that he evidently exhibited a fair amount of mobility because he was the champion of the Philistine army. Now, see, if he was a normal human, there's no way he could be a champion. He'd be just kind of standing out there like this, hoping not to fall down. And it better not put any weight of armor on him or weaponry, because that's just going to bring him down as well. But Goliath was the champion. And incidentally, one of the height indication this height was probably real is that the Israelite army, also had a champion, namely Saul. And King Saul was a head taller than all of his contemporaries. And that's really what the Philistines were trying to set up. Hey, we got our champion, you got your champion, let's have a fight. King Saul wasn't interested, okay? Which probably meant that, you know, King Saul might have come in, say, at 7 foot tall, but he was not interested in facing this guy who was 9'9" plus. So, again, that would argue that we're probably talking real measurements, cubits being 18 inches that we see here in the Bible. Yeah, question in the back? Okay, now I'm kind of leading you in that direction. And in terms of this debate, who are the Nephilim? Because I mentioned to you there are three theories. One theory is that they're strictly human. We've got the sons of God as the descendants of Seth. And what we have contrast in this interpretation is that you've got an evil line of humanity, namely the Cainites, and you've got a righteous line, namely the Sethites. And what was going on here in Genesis 6 is that the sons of God, which would be the men from the line of Seth, were having as their wives ladies from the line of Cain. And the people who use that interpretation will appeal to 2 Corinthians 6 and say there it says that believers should not have close relations with unbelievers. Well, the Cainites would be unbelievers, the Sethites would be the believers, and God really didn't want the gentlemen of the line of Seth taking his wives, women from the line of Cain. They went ahead and did it anyway. Our offspring were the Nephilim. Well, with that interpretation, you need to address the problem. What's going on here? How can somebody who's simply the human offspring of two humans, a human woman and a human man, be 9'9" plus, carry 250 pounds of weaponry into battle, and still be highly mobile and be a terror to the soldiers that are facing him? The other interpretation is that the sons of God are demons. It's quite the reverse, okay? Because in one case, the sons of God are the righteous. And in this interpretation, the sons of God are unrighteous. They're fallen angels. And these fallen angels violate God's command, which is angels, you don't mess around with the ladies that are part of the human species. But the text says they saw that they were desirable. And so these sons of God went and took women, human women, as their wives. And then they had the Nephilim. Now, in that case, you could argue, well, there's something supernatural going on here. And because we've got angels involved, that might explain why they're supernatural. Of course, one of the problems with that interpretation, does the Bible really support the conclusion that angels are capable of marrying women, having physical intercourse with them, and producing children? So that issue needs to be addressed. And then there's an interpretation which kind of falls in between, which says, well, what's really going on here is that you've got a human male who's taking a human woman and having this miraculous offspring. Now, what's causing it to be miraculous is the fact that this son of God from the line of Seth marries a woman who is not righteous, and he becomes demon-possessed. So somehow demon possession comes over him, and through that demon possession, we can explain the supernatural characteristics of these Nephilim. The problem with that interpretation is where in the Bible does it support that demon possession brings about these kinds of supernatural manifestations? Yeah, well, there is some anecdotal evidence, even with modern demonology. I mean, this is kind of how some people respond. They say, well, let's look at the database of people who have been demon-possessed. And there are cases where they exhibit what appears to be supernatural strength. I can think of one encounter I had myself with a demon-possessed man, and the guy was a wimp. When he was not under the control of the demon. You know, we had no trouble keeping him under control. He was a flab bag, okay? No problem at all. But when he came under the control of the demon, he could take on any one of us and causes considerable bodily harm. And there's evidence of that in the Bible, where it talks about this guy who was possessed with demons and nobody could control him. So you say there's some evidence that they're supernatural. Does that supernaturality extend all the way to having an offspring who can manifest the supernatural characteristics, not just temporarily? Because the anecdotal evidence that we can come up with is temporary. The demon-possessed individual occasionally can manifest what appears to be superhuman strength, but it's not there permanently. But in the Nephilim, it seems to be there permanently, that they have these supernatural characteristics. So now I'm giving you some of the ideas of what makes problems for the different schools of interpretation. You can see that their problematic issues need to be dealt with in all three interpretations. Now, what makes it difficult is you don't have a large scripture database on which to fall upon. Okay, but we do have some, and we'll get into that in terms of what makes this issue interesting. The physics of human anatomy is a critical issue to bring to bear on this debate, and it's missing in all the books I've read on the Nephilim and the Sons of God, all the articles I've read. By the way, people have been writing about this for hundreds of years. Again, if you get into theological literature, you'll see that papers have been written on this throughout church history. I got an accumulation of papers in my office that people have written on all three different interpretations. But what amazes me is all that literature is devoid of any discussion on the engineering of human anatomy. None of that's brought into the debate. What I'm suggesting is I think there's a critical factor to bring into the debate. Okay, young man back there, and then we'll come to Wes. Okay. Yeah. Now you need to repeat that. Well, the point he was making, it's not about his father's group had the assignment to go through the Sons of God verses. And as they were going through these verses, they were noting that, you finished this comment? Okay, supernatural beings cannot be tempted. There seems to be evidence that the sons of God are supernatural, and there seems to be a lot of counter evidence that they're not supernatural. By the way, that's what I wanted you to find out in doing the study of the sons of God. It's not as easy as it looks. Okay, you start going through the Bible, looking up all the verses of the sons of God, and what you discover is that some of them clearly refer to humans and only humans. Others refer to angels and only angels. You say, well, gee, this isn't going to help much in trying to reconcile this debate. And sometimes the sons of God are referred to as righteous. And I think what you learn from the study is that there seems to be a difference when the text talks about sons of God that are angels. And this text is quite clear, they're not righteous. And yet you get into a lot of the other texts where it's obvious that they're referring to human beings, and it looks like they're always righteous. What's going on here? Okay? So there's that little fact you want to bring into the debate. What about the sons of men? Same thing. Sometimes they're righteous, sometimes they're not righteous. But what makes it easy in terms of the sons of men, that phrase is never used to refer to angels. So in terms of the daughters of men, all interpreters agree those are female humans. And nobody's trying to suggest that the daughters of men are anything other than a human. The debate is on who are these sons of God. So the daughters of men are fairly easy to identify if you go through that little study on the sons of men, the children of men. You can figure it out. However, there's something theological I want you to pick up. Sometimes these sons of men are righteous. Sometimes these sons of men are not righteous. And by the way, the text is generic. It doesn't leave the ladies out. When the text speaks about the sons of men, it includes men and women. Okay, that's interesting. What about sons of God? It seems to include, no, not always, you are a son of God. You're a woman, but you are a son of God. And so you get into a problem there too. Yet in this text, the sons of God are masculine, and the daughters of men are feminine. Yet when you look at sons of God throughout the Bible, they can be masculine or feminine, likewise with the sons of men. It's a generic term. But it's not always a generic term. So this is kind of stuff I wanted you to pick up when going through the scriptures. Because often when people look at this problem, they say, I've got an easy answer. What I'm here to tell you is, there is no easy answer. Okay. I was going to talk to Wes first. I'll get to Wes and I'll come back to you. Yeah, sorry, Wes.
So
okay, Wes is bringing up an excellent point. And, you know, I've made this presentation in front of audiences before. They said, who says that if you get to be 9 feet tall, you're going to lose mobility? We observe that, of course. People that are 8 feet tall are not as mobile as people that are 7 feet tall, and 7 feet tall not as mobile as people that are 6 feet tall. We observe that. That gives us some basis for this engineering, but Wes makes the point, hey, there are exceptions. We see it in the animal kingdom. Look how tall giraffes are. They have four legs. Also, giraffes have lost some mobility. Okay, you ever watch a giraffe drink water? They have to spread their legs, get their neck down. It takes quite a while. And while they're drinking the water, they're in trouble. They're not in a good position to defend themselves as they're trying to get down like that. You know, and the lions know that, of course. So they wait for a giraffe to start drinking. They say, we're going to wait for a very thirsty giraffe to start drinking and see if we can get an easy meal. But, of course, the giraffe know that, too, and they drink frequently so that they're not exposed for a long period of time. Now, you've got elephants. They're real heavy. How do they manage it? Okay, yeah, there's a lot of bone mass in an elephant. Okay, giraffe doesn't have that much bone mass, but there's a sacrifice of mobility, and they have four legs. Elephants got lots of weight, but look at how big those bones are to support that weight. And by the way, have you ever seen an elephant jump? Okay. You don't see elephants jump. They can run at a pretty good clip, but they're not able to jump. So, yes.
Try a thoroughbred versus a Bercher.
A thoroughbred? Oh, talking about horses. I thought you were talking about dogs, and I was wondering, what's going on here?
Thoroughbred horse.
They run at San Anita. Mm-hmm. They have elegant out there with bushes and stuff. You get a draft for it. They may be strong. They may not box, but they're not. Right. So, that's an excellent. We've got a veterinarian here in the class, Ralph Skillen. He makes the point. Look at horses. What we've done with the horses is that we've bred them to get certain kinds of physical capacity out of them. A Belgian is not a horse you're going to want to jump over. What's that? Dressage, they call it? Now, you're not going to use a Belgian in a dressage. But you are going to use a Belgian to pull something. In other words, they're really good at pulling something forward. They're lousy at jumping over things. Likewise, you can take one of these racehorses, and they're not very good at pulling things, but they can move around the track at a high clip, as long as you don't give them a jockey that's very heavy. Now, give them a real heavy jockey, and they break their bones easily. Okay? And we've seen that with dogs, too. We've got dogs that are quite tall, but they're also fragile. So, yeah, Wes? We're out of time? Yes. Yeah, a lot of paleontologists have been very critical of Jurassic Park because they said what we know, the bone structure of T-Rex, he had to be a slow mover. There'd be too big of a risk for the T-Rex to move quickly. And they said chances are the T-Rex didn't have the musculature to move all that bone mass very quickly. And even if the T-Rex did, the risk of falling would be too great. And so they estimate maximum velocity of a T-Rex would have been like 12 to 13 miles per hour. In that case, you know the story that shows cavemen and dinosaurs together? Hey, we can run faster than 12 or 13. You could always get away. And so that means the T-Rex had to, you know, go after slow-moving prey or somehow surprise it. And when you're that big, it's hard to surprise. So, and it had a tail. So, you know, keep in mind that T-Rex has got 3 points of support. We have only 2 points of support. I mean, you probably all notice it's a whole lot harder for we humans to stand than it is for us to walk. Walking is easier than standing. I mean, just try an experiment. Stand in one place with your legs together and see how long you can stand. It's not going to be very long, whereas you can walk all day and not feel any the worse for it. And, you know, again, there's something in the physics of all of that. If you're standing still, I mean, your muscles are constantly working to support this. I mean, take 2 2x4s that are as tall as we are, put them close together, put a few joints between them, stack them up, and see how long they remain standing. Highly unstable. And we're also highly unstable. I mean, I look at all these animals looking at us, they must be wondering, you know, how does that thing stand up? Well, we stand up because our muscles are constantly moving in our body to maintain us, adjusting to keep us standing. And that's why people have to stand a long time. They tend to shift and move a little bit. What amazes me are these guard soldiers that, and what do they have them in the British Buckingham? They don't move. But they're miserable at the end of the day. Quickly, then we'll close. Yeah.
God would look down on people. And my, it seems to me that what he was actually looking for are ones whose hearts return to him, and those are the sons of God, and the rest of the sons of men, regardless of anything else. And that the ones that were sons of God were the ones who knew who they were in him, in a sense. And the rest of us, or the rest of them, were looked upon man for the criteria of how to live, how to be, etc.
Sure. And next time, we won't have time to do it today, but next time we're going to look at Jesus' reference to his followers and himself. It's really interesting that he called himself the Son of Man. Then there came a point in time where he called himself the Son of God. What's the difference? Okay. Father in heaven, thank you for this time we've had in this passage, and Lord, I pray that you would give us insight that would help us to deal with some of the destructive controversies that are going on, both inside the Christian community and outside the Christian community. Help us to find a way to make this a bridge, to bring people to recognize that this book we call the Bible indeed is the word from the one that created the universe and created us. In Jesus' name, amen.